This is Pearls and Swine on Good News You Can Use. I'm Levi, with me is Travis. And Lisa, I'm back from sunny Arizona. Last week I was down there hanging out in Phoenix, and I saw the sun. It was pretty awesome to see that, to warm up a bit.
You didn't look straight at it, did you?
I did for a little bit, because I didn't know what it was. But my family went down there. We went to the College Slam Dunk and three-point competition, which was pretty cool to go at Grand Canyon University. And who was there for the three-point competition? A guy by the name of Jack Gulkey. Do you guys know who that is?
I feel like I should, but I don't.
You should. Yeah, he's kind of a sensation.
Is that the Indiana guy?
Oakland.
Oh.
Yeah, he played for Oakland University. They were a 14th seed playing Kentucky, which was a third seed, and he came out and he knocked down, I think, 10 three-pointers, scored 32 points.
Yeah, ruined my bracket.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think he ruined a lot of brackets. But he was there. Nice dude. Really nice dude. And what was interesting is, like, nobody knew who this guy was, like, prior to that game. Like, nobody knew who this guy was. I mean, he even said, I was watching this interview with him, he said that he would walk around on campus and nobody knew who he was. His teammates called him the accountant because he literally looks like an accountant. I think he's in accounting. But, I mean, he just looks like some normal dude. But when we were at the game, what was interesting is he comes out and he didn't win the three-point competition. He comes out and he's standing there and people are gathering around him. They're gathering, like, young, old, women, men, kids. Everyone's gathering around getting pictures with him. But 2 weeks ago, nobody knew who this guy was. And I was just fascinated as I watched this whole thing unfold. And it was in, like, one of the little corridors leading into the stadium, and I was sitting next to it. And I was watching him just kind of interact, smiling, taking selfies with people, all of that type of thing. And I was thinking in my head, like, we're just attracted to greatness. Like, he's a March legend now. Forever, he'll be talked about. He's kind of a March legend. He, you know, David and Goliath type of a game. They beat Kentucky, knocked him out of the tournament. And he was a major part of that. And I was thinking, man, humans are just attracted to greatness. Have you guys ever been around somebody who you're just like, man, this is just impressive?
Yeah. I remember when one of my longtime family friends is an amazing musician. And every time we would see her in the summer, and she just is an amazing musician. She plays all different instruments. And every time she would play, I would like, I want to be with her and I want to be around her and I want to be like her. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was in high school, that was back when the Saints used to practice down at lacrosse for their fall camp. And that was Ricky Williams' rookie season. And just watching that guy, it was incredible.
It's like a tree stump
running. Yeah, I mean, his thighs were as big around as my waist, yeah, and he was fast.
Yeah. It's just interesting how just humans are attracted to greatness. It's like in our souls. We want to be great, and if we're not great or we don't think ourselves as great, we're attracted to other people who are great. And we long to be, I think, kind of esteemed or highly esteemed and regarded by other people. Things like Twitter, Facebook, Instagram are really kind of fueled by that desire. And you have social influence. Literally, people who make money off of being other people thinking they're great. They're influencers. And it's just a weird thing. And I was thinking about that, like, why is that? Why are we so attracted to greatness?
Yeah, I don't know. Is it because part of me is like, oh, are we attracted to greatness because we know we're not, but we want to be?
Might be. I think it's in our very DNA. I think it's a God-given longing because he's great. And I know that sounds weird, but you and I were made for greatness. We're made for significance. It's something that God put in the fabric of every human. And, like, if you run back to Genesis chapter 1, like, the crown of creation is us. Like, it's pretty amazing
Have you met us?
Wow, it's pretty amazing. Right. Like we are significant in all of creation. We're kind of singled out that we are the crown jewel of God's creation. And so there's greatness right off the bat. And I think there is greatness that is attached to who God is. And I think the problem comes in is that greatness, or what we desire, or what appears to be greatness, is twisted because sin comes in. And sin comes into the world, and our connection to the great one, like the one who is God, is, you know, far superior to us. And our connection to the relationship with him and seeing ourselves in light of who he is marred by sin, and we don't want the approval of God. I think it gets twisted that we want the approval and the applause of men or of people. And I think that's where it gets twisted in our world. And there's a really interesting text that Jesus' disciples, these are guys who've been hanging out with Jesus for a pretty long time at this point. Jesus is coming to the end of his ministry. And in Mark chapter 9, they have a discussion. Lisa, would you read verse 30 through 37?
Sure. They went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, "The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise." But they did not understand the saying, and were afraid to ask him. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called to the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all." And he took a child and put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me."
This passage, I think, is just, it has so many fascinating parts. Jesus and his disciples are on the move. They're cruising around. They don't want anybody to know that they're there in Galilee. And he wants to teach them some truth. He wants to, he's going to go to the cross soon. He wants to teach them that some things about the world in which he is going to leave them in. And you see this portion of this thing where he asked them a question, like, "What are you guys talking about?" And it tells us what they were talking about. They were talking about who is the greatest in the kingdom. And which I think is funny, just on its own. Like, who has that conversation? Like, "Lisa, I'm better than you."
Didn't we just do that like Tuesday?
Oh, yeah. Travis. Yeah. Like, it's just a weird, like, so you imagine weird. The conversation.
Well, nobody says it out loud.
Well, that's right. Like, nobody says these things out loud, but they're literally having a conversation. Like, I knocked out like 8 demons. I'm the greatest. Like how are they determining this? And I was laughing about that. I started to think about, oh man, maybe we do this too. Maybe we do this. It's the posturing that happens in your academic world.
I know nothing of that.
You know nothing of that? You philosophers. Uh-huh. It's the self-promotion stuff that we do. It's the one-up story stuff that we do. And I'm like, whoa, wait a second. We do the same thing. And it's all this comparison thing.
Yeah, but it's so interesting. I think that you just brought up the one-up people. And they are the people that are most honest about this conversation, right? I mean, anybody who's been in a conversation with someone who's a story one-upper, everyone wants to slap them because you're like, "Shut up, man. We get it. You think you're pretty amazing." But at least they're to some degree, they like wear it out there. You know what I mean? There's an honesty to their desire to think, I don't know, to their posturing. I don't know. That's a funny thing to think about.
Well, what's even funny about that is, like, I hang out with a lot of students, and they might not be like posturing in that sense of like, "I'm the greatest at this," but there's so many conversations about who the GOAT is of this sport or that sport. And everybody's got their arguments of why they think, you know, Jordan's the greatest or LeBron's the greatest.
He is, duh.
I agree. I agree with that. But like, there's this sense that we, if that's our guy that we're following or that is our number one athlete or whoever, our superstar, like we tie in some of our self-worth in that. And it's really weird because whether it's the one-up of the conversations or your accolades at work, like we're always trying to find that thing that we can attach us to that we know a little better or we think a little differently that makes us like postured up a little bit.
Or attach ourselves to greatness.
Yeah.
Like even talking about greatness, we're just attached to greatness. And so Jesus comes to him and he says, what were you arguing about on the road? So they're not just talking, they're literally arguing about this. And they think that Jesus has come and he is going to establish his kingdom here on earth and he's going to take them out of the oppression of the Roman government and probably the oppression of the religious leaders, the elites that have been around them and kind of, you know, squawking and looking down on them. And they're like, I'm going to be the top of the food chain here. I'm going to command these people type of a thing. And he says, what were you arguing about? But they kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. In this moment, it becomes very obvious that the disciples, they really have an agenda for Jesus, right? Like they have their own agenda for his kingdom. And it is to put themselves in a place where they are the top of the food chain. It's Jesus and them.
That's a really interesting idea that they had an agenda for the kingdom. Because I always read the disciples as like thinking that Jesus had the agenda, right? So they misunderstood what they thought Jesus' agenda was. But what you just said is like quite profound, actually, that they had an agenda for the kingdom that altered their understanding, or they placed themselves with a bad relation to what was great in the first place. That's really interesting.
We always have an agenda for greatness.
Yeah.
Like if I go up, like I'm not a big autograph guy, but like if you go and ask an autograph, what's the reason? So you can show somebody, like mm-hmm. I met this person. I met Al Kaline when I was a kid. My dad's like, ask him. But I was too shy. And so my dad asked him and he signed, I have an autograph from Al Kaline. One of the greatest Detroit Tigers.
Thank you. Ever. I didn't know. Thank you. That's helpful.
I could see the blank.
I was like, what the heck are you talking about?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we always have an agenda, like to posture ourselves or put ourselves in a place where we're above the other person.
I think we can relate with those guys, though, because they're hanging out with Jesus. He's become super popular. They've been given power to cast out demons. They've seen miracles. And it's like just our human nature to be like, well, like you said, I cast out one more demon than you, Peter, so I got to be a little bit better than you. I'm Jesus' right-hand dude.
Well, they know it's kind of wrong to like bring it up to him, right? Like that's just funny like to me. It says that they're quiet. And then... But Jesus already kind of knows what they had been talking about. And you expect Jesus, and maybe they were quiet because they were expecting like, oh, don't, we're going to get yelled at again because we don't get it. And you expect Jesus to rebuke them for wanting greatness. And you expect them to like, no, you don't need this. You shouldn't desire this. He doesn't though. He actually gives them the formula to be great, which I think is really fascinating. In verse 35, it says, sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, anyone who wants to be first must be the very last and be the servant of all. It's totally outside of our understanding of what greatness is, but he's giving them the formula of greatness, which I think is just really fascinating. He doesn't rebuke them, but he's trying to lead them into the greatness that they were designed for.
Well, and he flips everything upside down again. We view the Pharisees were the Roman government was, or just our society today. Those that do great things, those that are in high positions are the ones that have the power. And Jesus is like, no, these positions of power are really meant to be positions of service and humility. And that's not what we see in our world, you know? LeBron with his arms raised and his one less chip than Jordan or whatever he's right at now. Like, he's great, but like we just strive for that and we want, you don't just want to achieve it. You want to be noticed for it.
Well, if you go back to Genesis, like, what was the greatness of Genesis, of humanity? It's God created them. They were the crown jewel. They alone, like humans alone, have this unique relationship that they bear the image of God, which makes them great just in and of itself. They alone can know God as Father in a personal relation. They alone rule over creation. Humans were made for significance. We're made to be revered in a sense. My dog reveres me. I'm pretty glad about that. We're made to receive greatness from God, but sin turned that desire. Sin turned that desire to receive greatness from God to desire to receive greatness from other people. And I think that is the twist that is brought into this thing. What were they saying? And we want to be revered. We're going to stand by greatness. We're going to stand by Jesus, but we're going to be second in command so we too can be great in that. And Jesus gives them a totally different perspective on that thing. Jesus instructs them, if you want to be first, let me tell you how to do it. I'm going to tell you. He tells them, hey, you got to be last. And it's exactly what Jesus did on the cross. He went to the cross for people. The Bible says that we were enemies of God, that we were rebellious to God. We did not like the things of God. We didn't like the light that Jesus was bringing. Who likes to be told the truth? I don't know. And Jesus comes and he tells the truth with grace. He tells us the truth with grace and truth. He comes, but he tells us the truth. And people didn't like that. And they despised him. And all of this is, you see this in this, but he goes to the cross anyway. And that's the greatness of Jesus. He goes to the cross for those who would eventually be his people, would be restored to the greatness that they were intended, and for those who didn't or are never going to. He gave everyone that opportunity, which is pretty crazy in my mind.
Yeah, it is a different relation to greatness, though. It's not the absence of that relation, though. And I think sometimes when we tell this story, we maybe get it wrong insofar as we say Jesus is saying that we shouldn't be great. But he's actually describing what greatness is, which is another way. I mean, I think our understanding is skewed of greatness and what it actually looks like. And I think that's a beautiful way to read it.
In those last two verses, he says something I think that's really interesting. Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me and welcomes the one that sent me. And it's interesting, number one, that he talks about children, because children, while they're wonderful, they are resource sucks. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys know this, but in my house, they just suck up resources. They suck up emotional resources. They suck up food resources. They
socks.
Socks. Yes. Did I tell you that?
No, I told you that.
My kids steal my socks all the time.
My child steals my socks too.
I have to buy them on Temu every quarter. I have to buy 50 new pairs of socks.
Yeah, I go the Costco route, but yeah. I have socks all the time.
Yeah, like, anyway.
Resources. Children.
But he takes them and he says, if you welcome one of these, which is really interesting, which means like someone who's not going to necessarily repay you, someone who you look at and you might go, well, they're kind of beneath me. You're to serve them. And that's what he's saying. And it's like, whoa.
Well, and children often don't understand. I mean, our brains aren't developed till we're like 25.
Right.
So that's the other thing, right? This service without any kind of praise, service that sucks your very soul to live sometimes, service for people who don't understand all of the things that Jesus did.
And if we were to walk around the street and ask people, well, are you a servant? I think most people would say, yeah, I serve people.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that that's true, because the gift that you get out of service is you receive Jesus, not salvifically, but there's a receiving of Jesus, and there's a receiving, you get God out of this. You experience God, which I think is a really interesting gift in this.
What does that mean?
It's what he says.
I know, but what does that mean?
I think you're back to the intention of your greatness. Like, because you're to be in relationship without Jesus, you can't have that relationship with the Father. But he comes, Jesus dies, he becomes the servant of all, and we get a relationship with God. We get connected to him. We are being restored into, he transforms our desires from a plot of men to, like, we're highly favored, the scripture said, in God's eyes. Like, whoa, like, to think about that. Like, but the question, and I, like, was convicted in this of my own heart, is, like, the thought of, you know how much of a servant you are when you are treated like one. When people don't applaud you, when people don't recognize you, when they don't approve of you, they don't tell you thank you, you still serve them. You know how much you're a servant in those moments, not in the moments that you get praise or you get whatever. You get it in that moment. And what God says in that is you receive him and you receive something that's much greater. But the question I think comes is, like, because I don't really want to serve people that don't applaud me. I'll just be honest. And you can be honest too, because you all think the same. Like, if people don't like me, I don't really want to serve them, right? And yet, how much do I desire God? Like, that was the convicting part. Like, how much do I desire to be in the favor of God, to be connected to God, to know God in that way? Like, that was super convicting to my heart. Like, oh, crud. Like, because I think I often desire the applause of men or whatever more than I desire the favor of God in that.
Well, and that's how you see Jesus live. And I'm thinking about the Last Supper. He's washing the disciples' feet. And Peter's like, no, you can't do that. Like, you're the leader guy. Like, you don't do those things. And then Jesus is like, unless I wash you, you have no part in me. And then Peter's like, you know, wash all of me. And he's like, no, that's not how it works. But he still washed Judas's feet. And then after he's done with that, he's like telling them all that one of you is going to betray me. And Jesus knew he was going to not just get no thanks for that, but he was going to get handed over to be killed. But he still acted humbly and lowly as a servant, even in his position of really power and prestige.
Yeah, well, and I was just reminded when you were talking about this passage in John, when Jesus is talking about the religious elite, and he says in John 5, he says, you refuse to come to me that you might have life. I don't receive glory from people, but I know that you do, and do not have the love of God within you. I have come in my Father's name and you don't receive me. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and do not seek the glory that comes from the only God? And I think that's really...
It's convicting, isn't it?
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity said, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next person. We say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good-looking, but they are not. They're proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. If everyone else became equally rich or equally clever or good looking, there would be nothing to be proud about. It is the comparison that makes you proud. The pleasure of being above the rest. Once the element of competition is gone, pride is gone. If I am a proud man, then as long as there is one man in the whole world more powerful or richer or clever than I, he is my rival and my enemy. And I think that's another interesting thing. When we're serving other people, it gives us a perspective to actually celebrate who they are, celebrate what they've accomplished in a different way, because I don't have to compare myself to them. They can celebrate, like, their accomplishments or whatever that may be. And I think one of the other things is that Jesus, he tells him he's going to die, and he's despised by the world. And what we get out of that, Jesus came to rescue us to greatness. Because what we get out of that is incredible. We're highly favored in the eyes of God. Jesus became a servant to all people. Those who didn't like him, respect him, say thank you, so that they could receive the greatness that comes from God. They could have the possibility of receiving the greatness that comes from God. Jesus has secured that greatness that was made for us. He's restored that back. He brought that back to us that we could never have. Jesus secured a position that is so great that it makes him the GOAT, the greatest person of all times. And no one can ever challenge his greatness, because in Revelation chapter 22, it says no longer, and this is the destination for those who have received Jesus and get to receive the greatness that comes from knowing who God is. It says, no longer will there be any curse. The throne of God and of the Lamb will be in the city, and his servants will serve him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. There will be no more night. They will not need the light of a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will give them light, and they will reign forever and ever with him. Greatness here is like a nice suburb with low crime rates for a little while. Greatness with God gives you a suburb, a spot with no pain, no sin, no death, no evil. Greatness in this world can offer some fun experiences for a little while, but greatness with God is a spot near the throne where you get incomprehensible joy forever and ever. Greatness in this life can offer you a good relationship, maybe for a little while. Greatness that comes from God gives you face-to-face relationship with the Almighty, with the Creator, who is the source of everything that is good, everything that is right, everything that is true. Greatness in this life can give you a little power in business or in government, but greatness that comes from Jesus, you will reign with Jesus over all things forever and ever. They're not comparable. The greatness that God has came for, that Jesus came to give us, it is greater than anything that we can imagine. That's good news you can use.
Thanks for tuning in with us this week. If you've got questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can email those to travis@evangelup.org. If you'd like to catch up on any of the previous Pearl and Swine episodes, just search Evangel Houghton on your preferred podcast platform, and you can always find those at evangelup.org.